Welcome to 2819. This is the show where we hope to inspire you to go and make disciples of all nations. I'm Sandra Dimas.
And I'm Brian Rohenbacher. And this is a television outreach of Reasons to Believe, a viewer-supported ministry where science and faith converge.
And as you're watching the show, we just hope that you'll be encouraged to support resources like this show. And if you are, visit reasons.org/2819.
And for all of you watching on YouTube, make sure you hit that subscribe button down below. We want to make sure that you're keeping up to date on all the videos that Reasons to Believe is putting out.
And actually, while you're there on YouTube, also click over, find us on social media. You'll find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We're at 2819 Show.
And don't forget, the podcast version of 2819 is now available. It's on Apple Podcasts and Google Play. Just search Reasons to Believe podcast.
So I think it's about that time for a rundown, right?
Yes, go All for right. it.
So we're going to see in our Nexus segment a special talk from Ken Keithley. He's an RTB visiting scholar, and he's going to talk about Genesis as compared to ancient Near Eastern texts.
Yeah, this is a really good talk, so you're going to want to check that out. And after that, we have Culture Talk. And Sandra will be talking to Mike Strauss about why Christians should care about science.
And then in our RTB News segment, Monica's going to be talking with Ken Samples about the blood moon. It's kind of a popular topic that people bring up every now and then. And you're going to want to check that segment out. And then also be aware that for a limited time, you can use the promo code BLOODMOON50 to get 50% off of Ken Samples' book, Christian Endgame. Deals with a lot of end time prophecy and stuff like that.
Yeah, and a lot of people have questions about that. And even skeptics see the way Christians talk about it. And if we don't have a good answer, they don't take us as serious. So you'll definitely want to check that out. And then in our Give and Take segment, Jeff will be talking to Ken Samples and AJ Roberts about what if scientists create self-aware creatures? And I think we've seen enough TV shows and movies to know that's a bad idea.
Yeah.
But we're going to see what they have to say.
And then in RTB 101, we have Krista talking with Hugh Ross about an important question. Does time have a beginning? Let's check that out.
Now it's time for RTB 101. This is the segment where we talk about practical questions to help equip you to share your faith with friends and family more effectively. And you know, I've been thinking lately a lot about Genesis 1:1. It says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But it makes me wonder, does time have a beginning? And here to help me talk about that is my friend, president and founder, Dr. Hugh Ross. So let's talk about it, Hugh. The concept of time having a beginning, that is part of Big Bang cosmology, right?
It is, and it's part of the space-time theorem. This is also part of the Christian faith. It's what I noticed when I first picked up the Bible. It's different from the other holy books in that God does not create within time. He creates time when he creates the universe.
Okay, so let's talk about that, because you made a very provocative statement just now that the idea of time having a beginning is part of the Christian faith. So can you help unpack that from a biblical point of view?
Well, you quoted Genesis 1:1, that phrase, the heavens and the earth. It's used 9 times in the Old Testament, and it means the totality of physical reality, all matter, energy, space, and time. It helps to realize biblical Hebrew doesn't have a word for universe, but the heavens and the earth means everything, including space and time itself. In the New Testament, we actually have explicit statements that God creates time. I mean, 2 Timothy 1:9, the grace of God that we now experience was put into effect before the beginning of time, which you see in Hebrews, that the universe we can detect did not come from that which we can detect, and we have the capacity to detect space and time.
So the idea that there was something that came before time, the grace of God, the love of God, the plan of God, something like that makes it points to or seems to corroborate the scientific idea that time has a beginning.
It does.
How firm of footing are we on there scientifically that time has a beginning?
Very firm foundation. I mean, there's about 30 space-time theorems that exist today, and there's new ones being developed that basically affirm the biblical statement that when the universe has a beginning, time is a beginning as well, and there must be an agent beyond time that created everything.
Okay, so if I'm on good, solid foundation that time has a beginning from a scientific perspective, we also talked a little bit about the biblical case for time having a beginning. then what is God in? Is he like beyond time, or how do I think about where God is in relationship
well,
to time?
Well, he's beyond cosmic time, but the Bible makes it clear that God is involved in temporal experiences independent of cosmic time. I mean, the three members of the Godhead are in relationship with one another. They're actually working out the plans of redemption before they create anything. And from our perspective, that's a temporal phenomena. That opens up the possibility that God might be operating in multiple independent dimensions of time, or the equivalent, or since he can create space-time dimensions as well, he may have capacities completely independent of dimensionality. All that is possible. The Bible doesn't get explicit exactly how.
Okay. So would we say that God is independent of time or stands outside of time?
He's independent of time. He's also completely dwelling within time.
Okay.
That's what's unique about Christianity. God fills the entirety of his creation. He fills all of the space-time realm, and yet in no way is he restricted by the space-time realm he created. He can operate freely and independently of all space and time.
So Jesus can come enter into time in the incarnation when he came to earth and he was born.
And he can leave time.
And he can leave time. Okay.
Right.
So do you see this as kind of an evidence for the supernatural origin of the Bible? Like when I'm talking to my non-Christian friends, is this ever an argument or a case that you try to use to make for the reliability of Scripture?
Well, that was a big impact in my coming to faith in Jesus Christ, looking at the other holy books and seeing they describe God, his attributes, all in a context that can be comprehended within length, width, height, and time. The Bible stood alone in teaching doctrines about God, about creation, that were beyond what we human beings can visualize, which told me that the message of the Bible must come from a being that transcends the dimensions of length, width, height, and time.
So if people want to dig a little deeper into this, which of your books might you recommend?
Well, Beyond the Cosmos and Why the Universe is the Way It Is.
Very good. So we can encourage people to check that out if they really want more details or want to share this with a non-Christian friend.
Well, also gives them some hope of what to look forward to in the future when we're in a completely different realm.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah.
That God
this isn't the end.
The new creation
God's
is coming.
God's going to bring us into a completely different dimensional realm, and that's an exciting thing to look forward to.
It sure is. And I want to encourage all of you to check out Hugh Ross's blog, Today's New Reason to Believe. You can just go on our website at reasons.org and explore the new evidences that Hugh likes to track for the reliability of the Bible and the Christian faith. I know you're going to be blessed if you check it out. Now we're going to hear from our friend, visiting scholar, Dr. Ken Keithley, and he's going to talk to us about Genesis 1 and how that compares to ancient Near Eastern creation myths.
Genesis is a cosmogony. It is the account of the creation of the world. If you'll notice in the text that I just briefly surveyed, they were all theogonies. If you'll notice, what they were given an account of is how the various deities came into being with the various parts of creation, the gods of the hills, the gods of the cattle, the gods of the trees. Have you ever had an atheist say to you, maybe you've not, but I have had atheists say to me, do you believe in the Norse gods? No. Do you believe in the Greek gods? No. Do you believe in the Roman gods? No. So all of the various entities and deities and gods that the various polytheistic societies believe, you don't believe in any of those? No. Well, congratulations. I just believe in one less god than you. You're a 99% atheist, and I'm 100% atheist. Have you ever had anybody say that to you? Or something like that? What I say to them is, congratulations, you're almost up to the level of the Old Testament. Because that was exactly the point of Moses all the way to Malachi, is that the God of Israel is qualitatively, not quantitatively, qualitatively different from all of the other deities that people worship.
And if you'd like to hear more from Ken Keithley, visit reasons.org and search Ken Keithley. Welcome to Culture Talk. This is the segment where we talk about the intersection of faith and pop culture and how culturally relevant topics can be used to start conversations about your faith. I'm joined today with Dr. Mike Strauss, thank you so much for joining us. You are a professor of physics at the University of Oklahoma. Can you tell us about your research?
Yeah, I do research in what's called experimental particle physics. We study the smallest structure of the universe and the particles that make up the universe. And I currently do research at a laboratory called CERN in Geneva, Switzerland.
So that is the laboratory that was involved in that big discovery quite a few years ago, right?
Yeah, in 2012, a particle sometimes colloquially called the God particle, mm-hmm. or what we call the Higgs boson, was mm-hmm. discovered. I was part of that discovery.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.
And, you know, we're going to talk about a topic, you know, you're a scientist and I am not, and we're going to talk about kind of where we can find some common ground. So when I first became a Christian, I didn't have science at all, like as an awareness or a motivation to come to faith. But it is actually, I've come to discover, very relevant in holding on to our faith. So can you explain how those who are dispassionate about science or maybe not interested in pursuing it, how that can actually be comforting and helping us in our faith?
Yeah, you know, we live in a scientifically relevant world, from the cell phone you use to whether or not you eat genetically modified food. Mm-hmm. Science is all around us. And, you know, science, therefore, does affect us. So the other thing that's about a Christian is science can be a great ally to our faith. So even if science isn't necessarily something that interests you or that you think will necessarily help or benefit your faith, you probably know someone who it will. A friend or a relative or a coworker who, if they understood how science points to God, it might really benefit them. So I think it's worthwhile for all of us to learn a little bit about the intersection of science and faith and how they encourage each other.
Right. That's such a good point. I know when I first became a Christian, that was the first thing that someone asked me, oddly enough. Didn't have to do with natural evil or suffering in the world. Mm-hmm. It was dinosaurs. And I had no clue how to answer. It was just God did it and we're here, yay. And yeah. I didn't know how to respond. So would that be something then that people can use?
You know, there's a person that I know that homeschools their kid, and mm-hmm. their kid asked about dinosaurs and she didn't know how dinosaurs fit into the Bible. So for her it wasn't a big deal, but here she's trying to raise a child who understands how the biblical record is consistent with the scientific record, and she didn't know what to do with it. So that's a great example of a place in culture where it may not interest you, but just having some good answers can really help somebody else.
Right, and that's such a great point too, is that we might not find interest or value in science yet. Hopefully we get to that point where we do, but it will really help us to reach others, our children, our friends, right. Other Christians, maybe who are suffering and their faith is struggling.
Right, and that's the other thing. Like, you've discovered for yourself that actually that understanding of science can help your faith. Right. You know, sometimes it's easy to walk in my faith with Christ, but at other times it's really hard. And I'm looking, you know, subjectively, I may not feel like God is close or doing what I want. And then I need some objective evidence to kind of fall back on mm-hmm. and say, yes, what I believe is true. God is real. And sometimes that objective evidence that comes from science helps me in those times when the subjective relationship with God doesn't seem to be working.
Right, and that's good to remember, because you're right, like those facts matter when sometimes we're struggling emotionally, spiritually. If we can also rely on what we know of the truth of Scripture and the truth of the record of nature that God has provided for us, that can help kind of bring us back to a stronger faith.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so then what about non-believers? There are some people who aren't yet Christians, yeah. and they don't want to even entertain Christianity because, you know, let's face it, the common misconception is that it's anti-science, anti-intellectual. So how would we step into those conversations?
Yeah, and this is another reason why, even if, you know, the relationship between science and faith might not be interesting to you, you should know something about it, because mm-hmm. it's a great way to bring those who don't know Christ at least into a place where they are willing to investigate it. It's amazing that, you know, people understand that the universe had a beginning in the Big Bang, but they don't understand the theological implications of that. Mm-hmm. So with my friends who are interested in science and don't believe in God, it's an easy conversation starter to say, not only that the Bible doesn't disagree with science, but they actually support each other. And that the story of creation in Genesis is not some myth or fairy tale, but it aligns well with the scientific content, what we know through science. And, you know, some of my best feedback comes when I talk about how Genesis fits into science, because people go, no, that can't be true. Mm-hmm. And so it's a great way to engage people who think that there's this conflict, to show them that not only there's no conflict, but they actually support each other.
Right. Good stuff. Thank you so much. So then how can people find out more from you? Just read your content, check out what you're doing.
Yeah, I write a blog, michaelgstrauss.com, and I'm coming out with a book that's probably out. It's coming out soon, called The Creator Revealed, and information about that will be on my blog.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that. If you'd like to hear more from Michael Strauss, visit michaelgstrauss.com. Now we're going to head over to Give and Take, and Jeff is going to talk with Ken Samples about what if we create self-aware creatures. Let's check that out.
Hello, Jeff Zwerink again with Give and Take. This is the segment of the show where we examine intriguing and new scientific discoveries, analyze them and look at them, and help them see how they support the truth of Christianity. Today I'm joined by Ken Samples, and we're going to ask this question: are humans the only self-aware creatures on the earth? Ken, it's good to have you here today.
Hi, Jeff.
So this is a question that I was prompted to ask as I was looking at some of the scientific literature, and the title of the article I was looking at was this: creating this self-aware cyber slug. And so I guess the question I'd throw at you first is, how important is self-awareness to humanity? What does the Bible have to say about that?
I think it's very important. I mean, if we think of human beings as being made in the image of God, if we think of them in some ways as being exceptional, I mean, to be reflective is to be driven by reason, to focus on truth and reality. It seems to me that that's only possible with a unique form of self-reflection, which I would say comes in being made from the dust of the ground, the breath of life. Man becomes a living being.
So this does seem to be something that's uniquely human. And let's kind of flesh out, what does self-aware mean? Because, you know, you kind of alluded to a reflective process, capacity to choose this or that, you know, kind of not driven just by the environment, if you will. What would you say are kind of the key attributes of self-awareness?
Well, I think having the capacity to think abstractly, to think philosophically, to think conceptually, I'm not just in a room dealing with entities, but to think conceptually about different ideas.
So that would have kind of this connotation of, I can think about not just things I've seen, but kind of extrapolate to things that I've not seen, or things that
That's
might
right.
not even exist, if you will.
I can think about ideas that are not necessarily connected to physical entities. I mean, truth seems to convey that kind of idea. That I can think about the nature of reality, the way things are, the way things might be or mm-hmm. could be. I think all of that is rooted in a self-aware, and I think truth. It just gives us the issue of what is ultimate truth, mm-hmm. something more or different than what I see or experience with my five senses.
So can you draw a distinction to me? I mean, you know, obviously we can sit here and decide to have this conversation, or we could get up and walk away. You know, there's this aspect where that humans clearly have that self-awareness. But, you know, I mean, you've got pretty remarkable creatures, you know, dogs that will stay with their masters and go get help and do things. How is that different than what we're talking about here?
It's a good question. And I definitely don't think believing in human exceptionalism or believing that humans are special, made in the image of God, I don't in any way want to put down the remarkable qualities that elements of the animal kingdom mm-hmm. have. I mean, you know, whales, dolphins, elephants are incredible creatures. It does seem to me, however, that animals have a capacity for reading and understanding the natural environment. And on some occasions, they even come close to awareness or behavior. You know, we think about when animal species die and the way the others relate to them. But I still think there's a difference in kind. I mean, dogs, yeah, have this deep commitment to their owner and they seem to grieve and things like that. But I don't think these, even the remarkable animals, think about thinking. I don't think they create mathematical systems. Mm-hmm. I don't think they think spiritually in terms of, well, what's going to happen to my pups if I die? So I still think the differences in humanity are not in the level of just one notch on the degree higher. Mm-hmm. I think they're different in kind and thus a different kind of species.
Okay, so this, I'll kind of just flesh out a little bit of what they found in this article, because again, this is what they're referring to as self-awareness, is that they had taken this particular kind of slug, and you can see it in the article, this self-aware cyber slug that I've written about, that they were able to map the brain circuitry neuron by neuron, and then kind of put in a program that's kind of a learning program. So this slug now in cyberspace will be aware of how hungry it is. It will be aware of the environment in which it is. And it will even remember that this sort of animal, last time I bit it, it attacked back. Mm-hmm. And so there's this kind of awareness of its needs and environment and hunger. And it will make decisions kind of based on what the environment looks like around there. So this is what they're talking about as self-aware. Again, pretty primitive creature by all stretch. I mean, nobody Sure. disputes that. So if you heard someone come up and say, hey, here's this self-aware creature, why do you think humans are exceptional? How would you respond to that?
What strikes me, Jeff, is that what you've described to me seems more instinctual, cause and effect. This happened to me. I relate back this mm-hmm. way. I think what we're talking about is self-aware, spiritual, reflective. Who am I? Why am I here? Why is this happening? It's not just that this creature is attacking me, but why do things like that happen in the world? Mm-hmm. So it seems like a self-aware person is asking those more fundamental questions, metaphysical questions, deeply moral questions. And so even with... And again, I have no wish to say anything other than the animal kingdom is remarkable. God Agreed. Is to be praised for the beauty and organization and qualities that they have. But I don't think the animals ask questions about who am I, why am I here, what will happen to me when I die. Nor do I think they use their mind to control the environment the way humans do.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that was one of the things that struck me as I was thinking about this cyber slug, if you will, is that, you know, it has a sense of its environment and it can choose to eat or not eat here. But I don't get that. It seems to be very different than I can choose to not eat because I want to worship God today.
Yeah.
Or I could choose, even though I'm desperately hungry and need this for my survival, I can choose to give it to my kid. I don't see that level of awareness in there. And, you know, what's interesting as I was looking through the article is that they're saying that as we add more and more complexity, that we're going to replicate human consciousness. Mm. What are your thoughts?
Well, that's very optimistic. I'll wait and see, but I'm pessimistic. I think the idea of purpose, meaning, and significance is something human beings carry around in their mind, their heart, their will, that seems to be absent, or if it's there, it's not clear in the animal mm-hmm. kingdom. Again, I'd relate that to a philosophical quality that seems to fit well with the Judeo-Christian idea that God made human beings special by because they're made in the very image of God.
That is just a profound point, that we are the only creatures made in God's image, that we have the capacity to think abstractly, to reason. We actually think about making cyber slugs. There's no other creature on Earth that thinks about making other things like that. And as you investigate the literature and look at what the science has to say, it repeatedly affirms that we are unique and distinctive, and that affirms a profound biblical truth that God created us and us alone to be in fellowship with Him.
Hey, I'm Monica Jones, and today I have RTB theologian Ken Samples with me today.
Hello, Monica.
Hello. All right, so let's talk. I saw an online article that referenced this blood moon that we had not too long ago,
yeah.
And it was saying that this was a sign of end times. It was referencing Joel 2:31, So I immediately thought about your book, Christian Endgame.
Right.
Where here we have this resource that tells us we're going to see these headlines, and how do we separate that from biblical teaching? So tell me more about this book and why you wrote it.
Yes. One of the big reasons I wrote the book is to try to stay away from making predictions. I think that when Christian people, sometimes well-intentioned, but when you say the Lord's going to come in 1994 and he doesn't, that makes Christianity look bad. People begin to question Scripture. What I try to do in the book is I lay out all the major views about the millennium and these issues that relate to the second coming. And I try to talk about their strengths and weaknesses. And I also try to talk about what I call mere Christian eschatology. That is, apart from the controversies, what do all Christians believe about it? And I would say the central message of Scripture when it comes to the second coming is live a godly life. Mm-hmm. Be faithful in your calling here. Let the Lord worry about when he's going to return.
Right. So do you think that it's important for Christians to understand these different views of end times?
I think it is. The second coming is an essential Christian teaching. It's in the ancient creeds. Christ will come again to judge the living and the dead, and his kingdom will have no end. I tried to write this book as a primer. It's introductory. It tries to explore the different views. I don't try to strong arm somebody toward my view. It's a book about how to educate yourself about prophecy and the second coming.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, thank you so much, Ken.
Thank you, Monica.
So if you would like a copy of Ken's book, Christian Endgame, you can go to shop.reasons.org. And cool thing, from now till August 5th, you can get it for 50% off if you use the promo code BLOODMOON50. I really hope you'll get your copy. See you next time.
All right, that does it for us this week on 2819.
We hope that as you've watched the show, you've really been encouraged to share your faith and to do so with confidence and compassion.
And if you feel led to support resources like this show, please visit reasons.org/2819.
And don't forget to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We're at 2819 Show. Let us know what you think. Let us know if you have any show ideas.
And don't forget to get that 50% off Christian Endgame. You're gonna wanna go to shop.reasons.org and enter code BLOODMOON50. That's BLOODMOON50. Thanks everyone, and we'll see you next week.